Hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Right now, we continue with Morning Edition from National Public Radio.
Is encouraging the leaders of Ukraine and Russia to meet. A former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense offers an assessment of best-case outcomes of direct talks. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. In India, once positive perceptions of Trump have changed since the tariff war. I'm Leila Faldin.
And me, Martinez. Trump has threatened to double tariffs on India, but India is not caving in to his demands. Also, Baltimore's mayor on how his city has reduced violent crime and why Trump is taking the wrong approach in Washington, D.C. And the Cambridge Dictionary adds 6,000 new words. It's Tuesday, August 19th. Happy birthday to former President Bill Clinton. He's 79 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump says he's planning for a meeting between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Trump spoke after meeting the Ukrainian leader at the White House yesterday and then meeting with several other European leaders. All are focused on ending Russia's war in Ukraine. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer says up to 30 countries are willing to work with the U.S. to help offer Ukraine security guarantees. Starmer says any agreement must include Ukraine.
Whether it's territory or the exchange of prisoners or the very serious issue of the return of the children, that is something where Ukraine must be at the table.
President Trump says he also wants to set up a trilateral meeting with the Ukrainian and Russian leaders along with himself. A senior Hamas official has confirmed to NPR it has accepted a ceasefire proposal for Gaza. The move comes as Israel is gearing up for a major military offensive into Gaza. NPR's Jackie Northam reports from Tel Aviv.
Hamas came under heavy pressure from Egypt and Qatar to accept a deal and said there would be rounds of negotiations if and when Israel accepts. The terms of the proposal are similar to one recently put forth by President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff. It included the redeployment of some Israeli troops and more humanitarian aid going into Gaza. Israel had previously agreed to it, but since then, the government has been preparing for an offensive into Gaza City. An anonymous person in Israel familiar with the negotiations told NPR the government received Hamas's response from mediators and is studying it and would respond. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The strike against Air Canada is over. The union representing 10,000 flight attendants and the carrier both say they reached a tentative contract agreement overnight. The deal must still be approved by the workers. They walked off the job last weekend, snarling thousands of Air Canada flights. They even defied a government order to go back to work. The Texas Health Department says the measles outbreak is over. Texas Public Radio's Gabriela Alcorta Solario has more.
The outbreak of measles in West Texas reached 762 cases before the state declared the outbreak over. It originated in a West Texas county in January, and the cases quickly rose. But now it has been more than 42 days since a new case was reported. Two children died in connection to the outbreak. Both were not vaccinated against measles. 99 people were hospitalized. Texas officials say just because the outbreak is over here, the threat is still very real due to ongoing outbreaks across the country and globally. Monitoring for new cases will continue. I'm Gabriela Alcorta Solorio in San Antonio.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Justice Department says it's named Missouri's Attorney General as the new co-deputy director of the FBI. Missouri's Andrew Bailey will move into the job to serve alongside current FBI Deputy Director Dan Bongino, who is a former Secret Service officer and podcast host. There's usually only one FBI Deputy Director at a time who runs the day-to-day operations of the agency. Forecasters say Hurricane Erin is slowing down in the Atlantic Ocean. Top sustained winds are 115 miles per hour. Erin won't hit the East Coast, but it will still kick up life-threatening rip currents and surf along the East Coast. Fish may experience something akin to pleasure, according to scientists, and fish appear to work rather hard to feel it. Ari Daniel explains.
The team of researchers wondered whether fish could feel good. So in the lab, they studied butterfly fish and a ras that cleans parasites off other fish. The butterfly fish preferred being where it had interacted with the ras even when it had no parasites. But when the butterfly fish was injected with naloxone, a drug that blocks opioid receptors, it lost interest in the cleaners, suggesting there may well be pleasure involved with the massage.
And that this is mediated by those natural opioids in their brains.
Caio Maximino is a neuroscientist at the Federal University of the South and Southeast Pará in Brazil. Other researchers may need more convincing, but this could mean rethinking how we treat fish. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
In the National Guard, we have full-time service members, and then we have the traditional guardsman or the M-Day soldier.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is Jodine Eels, and I'm a police officer on the civilian side, and then I'm also in the Minnesota National Guard. As a traditional guardsman, you drill 1 weekend a month and then annual training period. So then you have a whole full-time civilian job. So the military is your part-time job that you still have a commitment to. It's stressful because usually when we go to training, we don't get days off, right? You work every single day. So I was gone for a whole month. I did not have a day off, right? I came home and I had to go back to my civilian job the next day. I was not on vacation. So it causes a lot of like frustration too, in that regard, when people like don't understand what I'm even doing.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at MinnesotaVeteran.org.
Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Trump has revealed his latest plans to end the war in Ukraine.
In a post on his Truth social network, Trump said he was setting up a direct meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky that would then be followed by talks between the two leaders and Trump. Now, the date and location are still unclear. That message followed a meeting at the White House on Monday where Trump hosted Zelensky and seven European leaders to make progress on ending the war Russia launched in Ukraine.
Well, we're going to work with Ukraine. We're going to work with everybody. And we're going to make sure that if there's peace, the peace is going to stay long term.
You remember, just days earlier, Trump met Putin in Alaska.
NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben has been following all of this and is here to break it down for us. Good morning, Danielle.
Hey, good morning.
So what stood out to you with these White House broker talks?
Well, first of all, it's just remarkable to have such a big group of world leaders come together on short notice, no less. And those leaders, they talked for hours yesterday. Trump and Zelensky met on their own, and then the other European leaders joined for talks. It was a scheduled meeting in the East Room that then carried on later in the Oval Office. One other thing that stands out to me, though, now that it's over, is that the White House is trying to create the sense of momentum here. Mm-hmm. Immediately afterwards, Trump said he spoke with Putin and that he had already started planning for Putin and Zelensky to meet face-to-face and that trilateral meeting you mentioned.
Okay. And Ukraine and Europe want security guarantees to keep the peace in Ukraine if there's a deal. What progress did the leaders make on that?
Well, we know leaders discussed this. Afterward, Trump said a guarantee would involve, as he put it, coordination from the U.S., but he didn't say specifically what that would mean. It's hard to know what to think of that without details. Trump also said yesterday that Putin is open to a guarantee. But again, we don't know what Russia is open to here. So a lot is up in the air there. But another thing the leaders discussed is the return of Ukrainian prisoners held in Russia, including children. And Trump said he thinks Putin is open to that.
Danielle, another central issue here is a ceasefire. At first, President Trump was pushing for an immediate ceasefire before any talks. Then he did an about-face after his meeting with Putin. And now he's been saying that he thinks they should just get into talks to work out a full peace deal. Did we hear more about this?
We heard a bit. We heard that Ukraine wants a ceasefire before further talks. And you did have Chancellor Merz of Germany and French President Macron really push for that. Now, without a ceasefire, Ukraine is concerned that Russia could drag out the war, continue its attacks on Ukraine, even as peace deal talks continue. Trump, for his part, though, said yesterday that he doesn't oppose a ceasefire, but also that it's not necessary.
And what about the issue of land? Did the leaders discuss the possibility of Ukraine giving up land that Russia illegally took or occupies?
Well, at least in their public remarks, Trump was the only one who mentioned it, saying that Ukraine and Russia needed to talk about that based on the, quote, current line of contact. Now, land is a very contentious issue in these talks. Russia already annexed Crimea in 2014 and now wants more of eastern Ukraine, which Zelensky opposes.
Speaking of contentious issues, I didn't see the berating of Zelensky that we saw back in February when he came to the White House.
Right, yes. You did not have Zelensky and Trump get into any arguments. In fact, this meeting, Zelensky seemed to be deliberately showing deference, thanking Trump repeatedly. He also wore a suit, which is something that Trump said that he liked.
NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thank you, Danielle.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, let's turn now to Evelyn Farkas. She's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia under President Obama, now Executive Director of the McCain Institute at Arizona State University. Evelyn, we just heard about, especially at the end there, how President Zelensky wore a different outfit. I got to admit, that's the first thing I noticed when he got out of the car at the White House, that he was wearing kind of a more formal jacket and trousers as opposed to his military look. And I think he seemed like he turned on the charm. And maybe more for the American people as much as it was for Trump and his cabinet in the Oval Office. What stood out to you for yesterday's meeting?
I think that's right, A. He came there ready to, you know, flatter our president, express appreciation. Of course, I mean, everyone's grateful that President Trump wants to stop the fighting. So, you know, he was expressing that through his attire, through his, you know, repeated thank yous. And he was much more relaxed as well, you know, joking around, in fact, about the attire with the reporter who had criticized him before.
Yeah. Now, as far as actual progress towards something like a ceasefire or a peace deal, do you think that was accomplished yesterday?
I am very afraid that the answer to that might be no. It is clear that substantive conversations are occurring. You know, the idea of a security guarantee is being discussed, but what I'm afraid of is that it is being watered down. And the crux of any deal, regardless of where you draw the lines on territory, and we should remind your listeners that this was a war of aggression that Russia, you know, launched against Ukraine starting in 2014, but then brutally in 2022, attacking Ukraine's civilians, raping, murdering, stealing children. I mean, it is a violation of human rights that we have not seen, you know, at this scale since World War II. It's violating, of course, the UN conventions, Geneva conventions, UN Charter, et cetera. So to give Russia anything is, of course, morally offensive, but, you know, for the price of peace and durable peace, the Ukrainians, I think, would be willing to do it, and that means their government and their people. But the durable peace depends on a security guarantee, A, and this is where I worry about how the various parties define that.
Yeah, because, I mean, it seems, and maybe I'm missing something, but it seems simple, right? A security guarantee would mean protection against more Russian aggression. If that's not what it boils down to, then I don't understand what it is.
Right. I mean, then it means war for the Ukrainians, because Vladimir Putin has not shown any sign, not in the things that he's said publicly, not in what his media is saying, not in what President Trump's reported out of their meetings, you know, not in the media leaks. He's not shown any inkling that he's changed his objective, which is to completely control Ukraine and wipe it as an independent political entity off the map. He wants to absorb it into the Russian Federation. And that is unacceptable under international law. It's unacceptable from the standpoint of European security. It's unacceptable in terms of what it shows the Chinese and others they can get away with. I mean, the stakes here are global.
Now, President Trump has also been talking about what he refers to as, quote, land swaps. I'm thinking of that term, Evelyn, and that means that two parties exchange something. But
right.
That doesn't seem like, what would Russia be exchanging in this scenario?
Yeah, I mean, that might have worked when the Ukrainians still controlled Kursk, which is a region within Russia that they actually took, as they said, as President Zelensky himself said, as a bargaining chip. Well, now there's nothing for the Russians to give in return. And so it doesn't seem like a swap. It seems like a forfeiture on the part of the Ukrainians if you talk about swapping.
Now, we might be accused right now, Evelyn, having a very pessimistic conversation when it comes to Ukraine's near and long-term future. But do you see any hope based on the last few days?
Yes. I mean, first of all, our president is deeply engaged. That is important because the United States has all the cards. What I would like to see is that the United States put pressure back on Putin. I don't think that Putin is going to meet with Zelensky separately. Mm. President Putin does not see President Zelensky as an equal. So the idea of this bilateral meeting, I think, is highly unrealistic. Maybe if President Trump were to agree to attend, that would be a different story. The other question, of course, is President Zelensky's physical security, because President Putin's people, his security forces, have tried to assassinate President Zelensky multiple times. So the bilateral meeting, I don't think, is possible, but we have a lot of cards. President Trump could put pressure on the Kremlin by, you know, slapping on sanctions, by saying, if you don't do this, I will do that, or if you do this, I will lift sanctions. So I'm going to put sanctions on you now, Vladimir. You now have to come to the table and give us something, which is an agreement that, for example, Ukraine can enter NATO, or an agreement that there's a real Article 5 with U.S. and European troops stationed as tripwires in Ukraine agreement, something like that. But I think the pressure has to be put on the Kremlin, and then an incentive has to be given. Okay, we'll take the pressure off if there's a peace deal.
Evelyn Farkas is a former defense official and executive director of the McCain Institute at Arizona State University. Thank you, Evelyn.
Thank you, A.
The conservative news network Newsmax has agreed to pay Denver-based Dominion Voting Systems $67 million to settle a defamation case tied to the 2020 presidential election. From Colorado Public Radio, Benta Berkland has more.
Dominion has been at the center of false claims that its tabulation machines flipped votes from Trump to Biden in the 2020 election. Dominion sued Newsmax and other right-wing media outlets and personalities for defamation back in 2021. At the time, Dominion CEO John Poulos said the company took this action because Newsmax and others showed no remorse for their barrage of lies.
So unfortunately, the disinformation continues and the targeted harassment of our employees and our customers and election officials at large continues.
In the most recent settlement, Newsmax did not admit to any wrongdoing. The media company says its 2020 election coverage was fair, balanced, and conducted within professional standards of journalism. Colorado's Democratic Secretary of State, Jenna Griswold, said she's glad Newsmax was held accountable for spreading election disinformation.
Election lies destabilize our elections and incite violence. Hopefully this settlement will prevent others from following in the footsteps of knowingly broadcasting election conspiracy theories in the future.
Newsmax has already paid part of the $67 million settlement, and according to SEC documents, will pay two more installments by the end of January 2027. For NPR News, I'm Benta Berkland in Colorado.
This is NPR News.
It is 6:19. Good morning. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. John Latimer will be joining me shortly. Coming up at 6:45, Phenology Talkbacks, and 7:20, John Latimer's latest Phenology Report. Coming up at 8:40, the latest in our series on forest fires, Ben Benoit from the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe will tell us about traditional ecological knowledge. We receive support from Dragonfly Coffee in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, featuring a scratch bakery and offering espresso, bubble tea, and more. Empowering inclusion and community through employment, special orders available, and more at drinkdragonfly.com. Patchy fog early this morning, then gradually becoming sunny, high 75 to 80, lows tonight in the mid to upper 50s, and tomorrow. Fog early again, and then sunny with highs in the low 80s. Central Lakes College in Brainerd invites musicians to audition for one of its 9 ensembles this academic year. Open to students and community members of any age, these ensembles offer opportunities in a variety of styles. Auditions are August 21st and 22nd, as well as August 25th. Call or text us if you need more information, 218-326-1234. Thanks for choosing KAXC this morning. There is more ahead from Morning Edition.
For NPR comes from this station. And from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From RBC Wealth Management, dedicated to providing financial strategies to help navigate wealth planning and legacy building. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Ahead of last year's presidential election in the U.S., many onlookers in India said they were rooting for candidate Donald Trump. But now President Trump is seen in India as an American bully after he threatened to double tariffs to 50% to pressure India to change course with Russia. NPR's Dia Hadid has more.
An expected trade deal between India and America stalled, apparently over India's insistence on protecting its agricultural sector.
What people don't like to say about India, they're the highest tariff nation.
That's Trump on CNBC in early August. He also attacked India because it is a major buyer of Russian oil. Last year, India bought more than $47 billion worth.
We settled on 25%, but I think I'm going to raise that very substantially over the next 24 hours because they're buying Russian oil, they're fueling the war machine.
Soon after, Trump announced he'd double tariffs to 50% if India did not stop buying Russian oil. The Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, said he would not be cowed. Since then, there's been small protests demanding boycotts of American products. Anchorwoman Palki Sharma seemed to sum up a national mood.
The deal is off, the tariffs are on. India is standing its ground. It has chosen strategic autonomy over succumbing to Trump's bullying.
Strategic autonomy
is sort of written into India's DNA.
Srinath Radhavan is a historian of contemporary India. Strategic autonomy, he says, is India deciding its own stance on particular conflicts and not falling in line with other countries. That resolve emerged with the creation of modern-day India in 1947.
Long years ago, we made a tryst with destiny.
Independence came after more than a century of rule by the British, who used India's blood and treasure to fight their wars.
India was taken in without even a hint of consultation about what Indians wanted. So for an independent India, it was very important never to be in that kind of a relationship.
But as much as India wanted an independent foreign policy, during the Cold War, it inched closer to the Soviet Union, partly because India's arch-rival Pakistan was a US ally. Events came to a head in 1971 when India and Pakistan went to war and...
President Nixon had dispatched the 7th Fleet, led by the world's largest warship, a desperate move to threaten Indian forces.
In this sympathetic retelling, India asked the Soviet Union for help, and Moscow sent a flotilla with orders
not to allow the advancement of the American fleet.
So in the days following Trump's threat to double tariffs, many Indians touched on the events of 1971, when America tried to bully India and Russia came to their rescue. India's friendly relations with the US began in the late 90s, with Washington hoping it would align with the West's agenda, including to contain China. In the decades since, the countries have drawn closer in trade, in tech, in military relations, in intelligence sharing. The problem is, analysts say, Trump isn't interested in that strategy of drawing India closer.
I think what his priority at the moment is essentially correcting America's trade deficits.
That's Ashley Tellis. He used to be a senior Indian affairs advisor at the State Department. And because Trump worries about trade deficits,
India moves from being a priority to a problem.
For now, Tellis says the Indian Prime Minister is falling back on strategic autonomy. Or you could call it hedging bets. India is still negotiating with Washington for a trade deal. India is also still buying Russian oil. Perhaps pointedly, India's top intelligence chief has said that Vladimir Putin will visit India this year. And the Indian Prime Minister is expected to visit China later this month after years of strained relations. Tellis says,
what he's trying to do is essentially mollify the Chinese to try and put some building blocks for a potential rapprochement in place.
A rapprochement to have in hand in case relations sour even further with Trump. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
In the past year, Cambridge Dictionary added more than 6,000 new words. And if you're not super online or super young, some terms may leave you scratching your head.
Yeah, one of the new additions is skibidi, which the dictionary defines as a word that can have different meanings such as cool or bad, or can be used with no real meaning as a joke. So, for example, what the skibidi are you doing, Layla?
I don't know if that word works with you.
What? Natural to me.
Skibidi is popular among Gen Alpha, another dictionary edition, by the way. And it comes from the viral Skibidi Toilet YouTube series, where a man's singing head pops out of a toilet. Much like the word, it's complete nonsense.
All right, so here are a few more additions. Delulu, which means delusional. Inspa, which means inspiration.
Tradwife is another addition, referring to a traditional wife who stays home, cooking, cleaning, caring for children, and posting on social media.
My husband's about to go on a boy's trip and his flight.
Nara Smith is a popular tradwife influencer known for celebrating domesticity by cooking elaborate meals from scratch and whispering narration.
I made a simple no-knead bread and let that rise for about 2 hours. And once
also making the cut, a combination of bro and oligarchy. Sorry, I got influence there. Bro oligarchy, referring to rich and powerful tech bros who wield political influence.
Adam Alexic is a linguist and author of AlgoSpeak, How Social Media is Transforming the Future of Language.
It's not new that we're adding new words to the dictionary. We've always been doing that. That's a time-honored process. What is new is all of these words are coming directly through social media algorithms.
A living language is always evolving.
Algorithms tend to compound and amplify natural processes of language change. So a word is kind of trending, and then influencers hop onto that word because our job is to find trends and perpetuate them because that's how we stay relevant.
Alexic says looking at origins is important.
Social media creates these communities that feel like they have a space to use their language, and then it opens up those communities just enough to allow their memes to spread. I do think by following where words come from, you can also follow conduits of cultural change and see how our culture is being influenced as a whole.
No cap, Layla. These new words are fire. I mean, if you use them, you'll finally have some main character energy.
Excuse me, I was born with main character energy. You're Delulu. This is NPR News.
What is life like when you have hearing loss, but no one can tell? For poet Raymond Antrobus, it's like living in two distinct worlds.
So I've learned how to navigate sound in this particular way. And it's, you know, a lot of that is a kind of invisible labor.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. My conversation with Antrobus on his new memoir, The Quiet Ear, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts at 4 o'clock here on People Powered KAXZ. Good morning. It is 6:29. I'm Jennifer Barr sitting in for Heidi Holton today, and it's Tuesday, so John Latimer is
good
in
morning,
the house.
Jennifer. Yeah.
Good morning.
Yeah, I made it in. It's starting to look a little foggy outside the window here, but it was not foggy on my drive in. Gray and maybe a little damp.
Yeah, a little misty.
Boy, I couldn't believe how warm and muggy it was when I went outside this morning. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's like wearing a blanket.
Temperatures right now, 64 appears to be the cool spot in Hibbing and Park Rapids. We've got 67 in Aiken and Brainerd, 66 in Grand Rapids and Bemidji.
Yeah. Oof. It wasn't a cool night. And it wasn't a hot night, but it was definitely, I don't know, I was surprised when I walked outside this morning. It wasn't any cooler than it was last night when I went to bed. So
right.
I was kind of like, wow, no change overnight.
Yeah, we are under a dense fog advisory for northeastern and central Minnesota until 9 a.m. We can expect some drizzle this morning, then gradually becoming sunny today. High 76 to 82, light north winds, partly cloudy overnight, lows in the upper 50s. And again, tomorrow morning, areas of dense fog, then mostly sunny, highs near 81.
Well, when Bob comes in, we'll have to get him to explain the physics of fog.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Consemius will join us in the 8 o'clock hour. And we'll talk weather with him. If you have questions about the weather or just questions in general about the physics of weather, get in touch with us. You can send Jennifer a text. You could send it to me, but you might as well just write it and throw it out the window. I maybe would find it on my phone, but probably not.
Yeah, you can text us 218-326-1234.
That's
love
so much.
To hear from you about what the weather's like in your area right now. If you're seeing big areas of fog, if you had some rain last night, it seemed very wet on my deck when I left the house this morning. But I didn't know if that was because it had rained or because it just was kind of misty and just very kind of thick outside.
You know, yesterday I was up in the bog and I found a few patches. I actually came through one patch of fairly heavy drizzle, but otherwise it was just like my windshield wipers were on the lowest intermittent setting and they were very capable of keeping up with all of the moisture that was falling. So it was more like a heavy dew or something. It was just kind of, it wasn't really raining, but it did accumulate on the windshield a little bit, and it darkened the tar a little bit, but I didn't see anything in my rain gauge worth measuring, so I would put it in as a trace, I guess.
Yeah.
Outside of that, what's our question for the week?
Have you ever lived with roommates, and have you had good or not so good experiences to share with us that are radio friendly?
Wow. I think the only time I ever lived with roommates was when I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I did have a roommate after college briefly, and then pretty much lived by myself for a while. And then I got married, and I guess you could call that a roommate.
Yeah, of sorts.
Yeah. I had mixed experiences. Some were great.
Mm-hmm.
Others were not so good. At one point during the Vietnam War, I had a roommate whose father was working for Honeywell making bombs.
Mm.
And that was pretty hard to take because I was pretty much on the other side of that argument. We ended up not being roommates through the whole year. We decided that our political differences were too strong and we'd have to split. So he went to a different room and I stayed in the same room, but got a different roommate and it was better.
Yeah.
But I've had some great roommates. I had one of my close personal friends, all through grade school and high school, and I roomed together in Minneapolis, kind of down in the area where, not far from where the U.S. Bank Stadium is now. We were students at the U, and he was a great roommate. He did have some idiosyncrasies. He would make up a batch of Bisquick pancake mix and then eat the pancake mix before he made pancakes, just eat it out of the bowl like soup. And I tasted it, but it never really had, it didn't have an appeal to me like it did to him.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing. It's like cake batter or something where like just a taste is like, this is nice just for a quick taste, but I would not want to eat it like soup.
Yeah, well, cake batter, at least you have some sugar in there.
Yeah, that too.
The Bisquick, I don't know that there was, if there were sugar in there, I couldn't taste it. I would be like, let's have a spoonful of pancake batter and a swig of syrup.
This would be a lot better if they were pancakes.
they definitely are better as pancakes. Trust me, I have tried both. Mm-hmm. I've given up on that. How about you, roommates?
In college, yeah. In both a dorm and then a different roommate, my second half of college, in an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And both were good.
That was
good
my experience.
Friends. Yeah. Yep.
I had one roommate, probably three or four different roommates through the dorm scene over the years that I was in dorms. And then after that, I was sort of having an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of a thing. Roommates are, it's a good experience. It helps you to understand that we're all different.
Everyone is not like you.
Yeah, everyone is not like you. That's right. Yeah. Well, if you have had an experience with a roommate, why don't you get in touch with us and tell us about it? We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, text 218-326-1234. Support for KAXE comes from Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, continuing their Martini Monday music series with Grand Rapids musician Greg Kayser, performing August 25th from 5 to 8 p.m. More info on the music series at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com.
And support for KAXE comes from the Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org.
Coming up, we'll have National Native News, and then we'll take a look at what we've heard from our listeners this week.
We're a little light on recorded talkbacks today, so now, while you're listening to National Native News, if you've got an observation or just something you'd like to share with us, send it along. We'll read your texts.
218-326-1234.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho students will have a crack at a new scholarship at the University of Wyoming. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman has more.
UW is creating the Wind River Promise Fund. $250,000 will be available to tribal members to cover undergrad tuition costs and mandatory fees for full-time students. The idea has been going back and forth between tribal members, state legislators, and the university for years. UW trustee Paul Ulrich says the move is something to celebrate.
I think this is a long time coming, and I am absolutely thrilled to death that this motion has been made today.
An additional $2 million will be managed and invested like an endowment. Students must be enrolled tribal members to qualify. They also need to be Wyoming residents and graduate from a Wyoming high school. I'm Hannah Haberman.
Many clean energy initiatives across the country have been hit hard with federal funding freezes and cuts in recent months. The two villages in Alaska are considering a project that would harness the energy of ocean waves. Yolna Niden with the Alaska Desk reports.
Waves gently hit the shores of Kachemak Bay as ravens croak above on a cloudy night in July. The small village of Port Graham is nested here at the southern tip of the Kenai Peninsula. The village may soon convert wave energy into electricity. Danielle Malchev is the first chief of Port Graham.
I have a lot of hope that this is going to be something great for our community.
Chugachmyut is a consortium that serves native tribes, including Port Graham and its neighbor, Nanwalik. The consortium announced it had partnered with an Australia-based company, Carnegie Clean Energy, in May. Carnegie has several wave energy projects across the world, but this would be the company's first commercial installment in the U.S. That's according to Louise Richardson, Carnegie's commercial analyst.
One thing at Carnegie that we hope our technology will be able to service in the future is remote communities and isolated communities that might not have access to other forms of renewable energy options.
Port Graham and Nanwalik have no roads connecting them to the rest of the state. Energy costs there are high because the villages are at the edge of the grid and diesel for a backup generator comes on a barge. The electrical lines running from Homer are several decades old, don't have enough capacity, and are unreliable. Malchev says the village loses power several times a month in winter and once every few months in summer.
We have to use satellite phones if our power is out, which isn't very convenient when you're trying to relay and talk to doctors in the ER and you're dealing with a patient.
Malchev says more reliable electricity from wave energy could solve some of those issues. And ideally, the villages can sell any extra energy back to the grid and use that revenue on healthcare and education. The plan is to place a wave energy device offshore from Port Graham. Permitting, testing, and installation of the project might take close to 5 years. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naidin.
Over the weekend, in a social media post, the Gathering of Nations announced its final powwow. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
In a Saturday social media post, the Gathering of Nations announced that next year's powwow will be the last dance. It's been an Albuquerque annual tradition beginning in 1983, drawing thousands of performers and spectators from across Turtle Island over the last four decades. On the event's website, organizers cited several factors beyond their control, making long-term planning and coordination challenging without specifically saying why. The 43rd Gathering of Nations will happen next April at the New Mexico State Fairgrounds. I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohanic Broadcast Corporation and funded by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. You can hear the latest version this afternoon at 4:30 during All Things Considered here on KAXC. It's 6:42. I'm Jennifer Barr with John Latimer. Thanks for listening to the Tuesday morning show.
Remember, if you have an observation that you'd like to share, maybe something happening in your yard you'd like to tell us all about, we'd love to hear from you. We are out of talkbacks this morning, and we expect that to change very soon as we get back into the school year. But if you are out there and have some observations to share, we'd love to hear from you. So send them along as a text, 218-326-1234. We'd love to hear what you have been seeing.
We are going to listen to our album of the week now. It is called Now Would Be a Good Time, and it's by Folk Bitch Trio. They are an Australian trio of high school friends formed in 2020, and this is their debut on the Jag Jaguar label. And it has dazzling harmonies and keen observations on life in your 20s in the year 2025. You can let us know what you think of it. Text 218-326-1234. The song we're going to hear is called Cathode Ray.
Oh,
better late than dead on time. And once when you weren't looking, I made you mine. Down the exit aisle, coming out strange, like I come off a long flight. We get home, get the scalpel out, and just for fun, you say, show me what it looks like when you come.
From our album of the week, that is Folk Bitch Trio with the song Cathode Ray. The album's called Now Would Be a Good Time. We'll be having more about that on our website, kaxc.org.
Lovely voice.
Yeah, very lovely harmonies. Yeah. I'm Jennifer Barr, sitting in for Heidi Holton today with John Latimer, and it's the Tuesday Morning Show on KAXC.
Normally at this time, we'd be listening to some talk back from our students and from just general listeners. And this week we are without audio communication.
Our camps, I think, are winding down.
Yep.
School has not yet started. So we're kind of in that in between, even though there's lots happening out there.
Right. Well, I've gotten a few emails that I'd like to read, including this one that comes from Kathleen. And she says, thought you might enjoy last week's foraging fun. We were having steaks and corn on the cob for dinner. My cabin yard is filled with small and tiny puffball mushrooms. I did a bit of harvesting and cleaning. We fried them up with some onions and garlic. What a great meal accompaniment. Earlier this summer, we sautéed them up in scrambled eggs for breakfast. Alas, this may be my last harvest, as I can see the maple leaves are starting to turn red. And that from our friend Kathleen. And Kathleen, there are some maple leaves that are starting to turn red right now. And, it's a, what would you call it, a sort of a bell curve. There are those that start early, and then there are those that start on average, which would be mid to late September, And then there are those that won't even start until early October. And I'm not sure if those are the F maple trees or the A maple trees, but on the bell curve, they're at one end or the other. So I guess it's...
I thought that was like an official name of maple trees. I was like, oh, I've never heard of
it. No, I just, I think of, you know, there's like, curve, there's, like, yes. Like there's, you know, in school, there was always the curve, you know, uh-huh. And there was like the A students and then it started climbing in B's and then up at the top were the C's and then came down the D's and then at the bottom were the F's. And I won't tell you where on that scale that I landed, but let's just say there wasn't a long fall from where I was to the line.
Yeah. Well, it's nice they don't all go at once, I think.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. Yeah. Kind of. And the first ones, it's kind of fun because, you know, they're like the first ones in here. I've got a couple of them. There's one on the River Road that I admire that's turning, and there's one out at Sugar Lake Lodge that's turning. And so here and there, they're, you know, it's like, hey, if you want to call attention to yourself, what better way? I got this note from Phil, and Phil lives down in Hill City. And let's see, he says, hi, John. Thanks for your years of dedication to phenology and all of the students and people's lives you have touched with your stories and educational approach. We have always had pileated woodpeckers near our house. This summer, the parents and the youngsters are regular visitors to our feeders and suet paddle. And he sent along a picture, and the picture, I can't do it justice, but imagine a sort of an 8 foot high snag. So there's this tree stump there that's like 8 feet high, and he's got his suet feeders stuck on that. And as far as a natural perch for woodpeckers, it is absolutely gorgeous. If I were a woodpecker, I would want to come there and eat. Thanks, Phil. What a nice note and a lovely picture. Phil's down in Hill City, and we're always happy to hear from folks like that. His woodpecker feeder is one for the ages. I would definitely like to have that sort of a feeder at my house. The blue jays at my house have discovered that suet is really good. And the blue jays come in six or seven at a time, and they take turns fighting with one another over who gets to eat the suet. I think that they ought to like leave the suet for the woodpeckers, because they're perfectly happy to eat the seeds. And in a week or so, they're going to have plenty of acorns to hide.
Yeah.
So I think they should just, you know, let the suet be for the woodpeckers. That doesn't seem right. And another friend of mine, a fellow named Dave Lorenz, sent this along. He said, let's see. Finally saw my last Baltimore Oriole on Thursday. Only chickadees and bees since then. Dave has had Orioles coming to his feeder all summer and had remarked about a week ago that he thought maybe the Orioles, because they hadn't come that particular day, thought that they might have left. And this is, in fact, the time of year when the Orioles begin to move out. Same for the rose-breasted grosbeaks. And I still have a few rose-breasted grosbeaks at my house, but more juveniles than adults. And those guys have already begun to migrate. So like the early maples, some of these birds, like orioles and grosbeaks, have begun to slide out of the area. So it is, in fact, it's past the midpoint of August. And so by my reckoning, I have about a month left of swimming outside.
We got a text from Bill in Wabana. It says, good morning. Two maple trees here, one by the lake and one on high ground, that have both have leaves that have turned quite red. Also a pair of fawns who have almost lost their spots, just barely discernible. In addition, one of the fawns is roughly 25% bigger than the other fawn, suggesting a buck and a doe fawn.
Hmm. Very nice.
Interesting observation. Yeah.
I had a conversation with a couple of folks yesterday about fawn, about deer, and they had seen two does that had twins. I have not seen a doe with twins at my house. Mostly the does that I'm seeing have a single. And I don't know, you know, the last couple of winters haven't been that tough. So I would have thought that the deer would have responded pretty well, but apparently, at least not around my house. But these folks I was talking to are only about a mile from my house, and they had seen two does with twin fawns, and that's encouraging. Nice to know that there are some does that are producing large, well, average numbers of offspring. I think I read several years ago that the average number of fawns produced by does by white-tailed deer is greater than two. Like the number is like 2.3 or something like that. I'm sure somebody out there probably knows the exact number. Let us know. But more than two. So twins are common, and triplets are not out of the realm. And so it's kind of interesting to think that their reproductive success can be that great. We'll let you know. I'm sure many of you are probably getting ready. We're a month away from deer season, actually, archery and grouse and early duck season. So there are a lot of hunting seasons that are about to be upon us, and many of you are probably anticipating that, getting out and getting your equipment together and getting it ready, getting your dog trained, and making time for a little extra time in the woods. And there's nothing wrong with that. I encourage everybody to get out in the woods at any time for any reason, unless it's like poaching. Don't do that. Yeah.
We heard from Lisa in Balsam Township. She said the fog is so dense here on Sand Lake, I cannot see the other side. Some of the dogwoods are turning a lovely shade of purple red.
Oh, yeah, probably the large leafed. I have a pagoda dogwood in my yard that is turning. A couple of the branches have begun to turn color there, and I think that they may be dying. Not the whole plant, but that particular branch. And it's always fun to look at the dogwoods, all of them. If you're outside and you come across what you suspect is a dogwood, if you carefully tear the leaf in half along the short axis, the two halves will cling together because the veins are kind of thready, and they hang these little tiny, almost spiderweb-like threads that hold the two halves of the leaf together. And that's how you know it's dogwood, because no other plant that I know of actually behaves like that. And so you can have round leaf dogwood, which have great big leaves. This time of year, the round leaf dogwoods are going to have clusters of berries that probably now are going to be sky blue, but they will get darker as the season goes along. My pagoda dogwoods berries were ripe probably last week, and the birds have really wiped them out, really. I mean, from hundreds of berries on the bush to two dozen or so, just one or two here and there that are left behind. The structure that they grow on and on the pagoda dogwood is red, so they're quite beautiful because the leaves are dark, dark green, those that are not yet turning color, and they make for a lovely contrast. It's just really a beautiful situation to check those out. So get outside. Everything I read and everything I understand about, education and physical health, mental health, is all improved if you get outside. So go outside. and take in the sights and sounds, and then send us a note and let us know what's happening in your neighborhood. We'd love to hear from you.
We also want to plug the Little Falls Phenology Instagram. They are posting several times a week. Their latest post has some beautiful photos of ruby-throated hummingbirds, a Nashville warbler that looks to have perhaps got a little stunned. It's in someone's hand, but yeah. We hope that's okay. Some